Brian Lehrer on WNYC. If you haven't heard the big Atlantic Yards news yet this morning, New York State's highest court says the state can use eminent domain to force homeowners and businesses to sell their properties for that massive development in Brooklyn that includes a new arena for the Nets. It was a 6-1 ruling today. The Court of Appeals said the Empire State Development Corporation's finding that the area was blighted was enough to justify taking the land. A group of tenants and owners that went to court claimed it was unconstitutional that developer Bruce Ratner's proposed $5 billion, 22-acre Atlantic Yards project mainly enriches private interests while the state constitution requires public use for taking land. But they lost. Ratner's proposed development includes office towers, apartments, and a new arena for the NBA's Nets if the economy allows it to all go forward anyway. So that just in, a big win in court on the eminent domain question for the potential developers of Atlantic Yards. And we'll get a reaction to that in a minute from New York City's Housing Preservation and Development Commissioner. Wanted to check in with our Uncommon Economic Indicators Board, which continues on our website. It looks beyond things like the Dow and the top line deficit numbers at economic indicators that you see in your lives and in your neighborhoods. So here are some of our recent posts, and we invite you to keep contributing. This one's called Baby Bust by an anesthesiologist named David. It says, yesterday I was the anesthesiologist assigned to labor and delivery for the day at my hospital. Posted this on the 17th. Whereas a typical Monday would normally be composed of 2 or 3 C-sections and several vaginal deliveries, yesterday was quiet, with only one delivery during the 5 hours I was there. The nurses told me it has been very quiet the past several weeks and suspects that fewer babies were conceived after November 2008. We'll see how long it lasts, writes anesthesiologist David. Then this one, titled Fairway Freebie, submitted by Nancy, on the Upper West Side, about a week and a half ago, it says, received a flyer in the mail yesterday from Fairway offering $10 off any purchase over $75. In 20 years on the West Side, I think this is a first. So if even Fairway is offering discount coupons, maybe that says something. How about this one? Babysitters looking for jobs, posted by Dimitri in Fort Lee. I am a member of a Yahoo club for Russian-speaking parents. I am seeing more and more ads on our forum whose gist is, good babysitter available ASAP due to my family situation. I had to let go of a good babysitter. He says, looks like people are losing jobs and letting babysitters go. He says, before the spring or summer of last year, we had virtually no such posts. Most of the babysitter-related posts back then discussed arrogant babysitters who were requesting too much in pay, vacation, perks. Situation clearly changed since then, writes Dimitri in Fort Lee. And finally, ticker tape, ticker scrape, submitted by Giuseppe, back on the day of the New York Yankees ticker tape World Series parade. He mentioned his location as Canyon of Heroes and said toilet paper and shredded office paper replace good old ticker tape in the Yankees parade as an uncommon economic indicator. Post your uncommon economic indicator stories or photographs to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Now, one thing that's easy to predict about Mayor Bloomberg's third term, the tug of war between government and the market forces will continue over affordable housing. In October, during the campaign, the city estimated that it had created or preserved 94,000 affordable apartments, including 72,000 for low-income households. That's a lot during anyone's 8 years in office. Here's Mayor Bloomberg recently announcing one such project in Harlem.
This, we think, will not only strengthen our neighborhoods by creating hundreds of affordable homes for low and middle income New Yorkers, it's also going to produce some 2,800 well-paying jobs throughout the city.
So that was one project in Harlem. 94,000 affordable apartments created or saved in 8 years. But at the same time, an NYU study estimates that the city has lost 200,000 affordable units to market forces like gentrification and to rent deregulation by government, most of it in the mayor's first term. The recent court ruling on illegal rent deregulation at Stuyvesant Town may bring back some affordable apartments, but only those with a certain tax break known as J51. So what will Mayor Bloomberg's affordable housing strategy be going into his third term? We are very happy to have with us now Housing Preservation and Development Commissioner Rafael Sestero. He succeeded Sean Donovan earlier this year when President Obama named Donovan the U.S. Secretary of Housing and Development. So Obama must have thought Mayor Bloomberg was doing something right. Commissioner Sestero, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Brian, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
Do you buy the basic idea of a tug of war between your affordable housing efforts and market forces?
Well, Brian, I think in, you know, generally speaking, in the history of New York, whether it's in this administration or in other administrations, that's what HPD has set out as its mission to do, which is to both work with the market, but also work with other branches of local government to create more affordable housing and make New York City more affordable. And it's always a constant adjusting of our plans and our programs to deal with what the market realities bring us in a particular year or a particular era.
So do you buy the rough stats from the NYU Furman Center study that 200,000 affordable units were lost to gentrification and rent deregulation during the mayor's first 8 years, more than twice as many as were created or saved?
There's two things I would point out about those numbers, Brian. The first is that I think it's important to look at the segmentation. So if you look at the period between 2002 and 2005.
Whoops, did we lose the commissioner? Commissioner, you there?
I'm still here.
Sorry, we lost just for a second. Go ahead.
Oh,
between
okay.
2002 and
between 2002 and 2005, there was a loss of units with rents that were affordable below 80% of median income of about 206,000. The important part is that that's exactly why this mayor made an unprecedented commitment to affordable housing, because we knew that the city and the market, if left to its own devices, would make the city more less affordable than otherwise. And so we stepped in with a 10-year, 165,000-unit plan. And if you look at between 05 and 08 in NYU's numbers, what you begin to see is the fruits of that labor. What you begin to see is that loss of units, 206,000 units by NYU's count between 02 and 05, was completely arrested by the fact that units created under the new housing marketplace plan were coming online and being rented to families around this city. And in fact, between 05 and 08, there was a net increase in the number of units in this city that were affordable to folks below 80% of area median income, which, to give you a sense, is roughly $60,000 for a family of four. And so if you look at over time, if you look at what happened as the mayor's plan began to take effect, I think you really do begin to see the Bloomberg effect on the housing market, which is it's becoming more affordable. We've arrested the loss of affordable units and are actually now beginning to add to the stock as time goes forward. And that's what we'll see over the next 4 years.
And listeners, we can take a few phone calls. For Rafael Sestero, New York City's Commissioner of Housing Preservation and Development, 212-433. WNYC, 212-433-9692. Jabril, I see your call up there, a cab driver wanting to know how to qualify for affordable housing. We'll get to you in a minute. How, in the big picture, are you fighting the tide in the third term? Go ahead and tell us about the administration's efforts and how you're picking up from where Sean Donovan left off when President Obama hired him, and whether you've kind of got the low-hanging fruit, if you will, over 8 years, and now it becomes tougher.
Well, I think, Brian, what Secretary Donovan did in his term at HPD was lay a terrific foundation for success. 94,000 units is a truly remarkable accomplishment by any indicator and dwarfs what any other municipality around the city, around the country is doing. What we're going to do going forward is we're going to, number one, ensure that we meet the commitment, 165,000 units by the end of 2014. But we're going to do that in a way that responds to the changed environment. The biggest change going forward in the housing plan will be that we now recognize that what the market is saying to us for currently existing occupied affordable buildings is that owners are not taking those to market in the droves that they were before, and that they're recognizing that preserving those units as affordable is an opportunity for them, and it's a tremendous win for the tenants in those buildings. And so we're going to ensure that we're putting more resources than ever before towards preservation and towards ensuring that we keep the affordable housing stock that we have in place, so that every new unit, some 25,000 new construction units that we'll create over the next 4 years, is an added unit to the city's affordable housing stock and will lead to the ultimate goal of the new housing marketplace plan, which is to make New York City more affordable.
And you're a big proponent of inclusionary zoning to spur new affordable housing creation, aren't you?
Absolutely. And I think that...
And explain that concept to our listeners who don't know the term.
Sure. So what inclusionary zoning does is it says to a developer of a market rate property that you can build a market rate property and you can get additional density in that building that you're going to build, so you can create more units overall, but you have to give us affordable units in order to do that. 20% of the units at a minimum have to be affordable to families who earn 80% of median income or below. And it's that exchange that allows us to really capitalize on market forces and empower the private market to also create affordable units. But I don't want to overemphasize the importance of the inclusionary program in our plan. It's a 165,000-unit plan. The inclusionary program, we think, will generate several thousand units towards that plan.
And that's all.
And it's an important program, but it's not the bulk of how we're going to get to 165,000 units.
So what's the biggest piece going forward?
The biggest piece of our plan is going to be investing in our existing stock, investing in the buildings where people live now, and ensuring that those folks that live in those units can stay there and have affordable rents for the long run, and that those buildings are assets to strengthen neighborhoods across the city.
What does that mean? Does that mean the city giving money to landlords in buildings that have affordable units now? And to do what? I mean, if people are already living there, and presumably the landlords are already, making a reasonable profit, what's the city's role in that?
So I'll give you a concrete example, Brian. The Mitchell Llama program, which is a program that many New Yorkers know about, created 110,000 units of housing during the 60s and 70s. Those units are allowed to go to market at the end of 30 or 40 years. What we have done during the first part of the new housing marketplace plan, and what we hope to do even more of going forward, is provide the right set of money and tax incentives and regulatory incentives to those owners so that they stay in the Mitchell Llama program. To date, we've preserved 28,000 units of Mitchell Llama housing around the city. We expect to do 20,000 more units going forward. The preservation of Sterrett City is a perfect example of this, where we work together with the state and federal government to ensure that the owners of Sterrett City had the right set of tools that they needed to refinance that property, provide capital improvements that improve the quality of life for the residents, but keep that property in the Mitchell Llama program going forward, so that those 6,000 units are preserved for the long term for the families that live there now and for future families that want to live there going forward.
New York City Housing Preservation and Development Commissioner Rafael Sestero, my guest on WNYC. And now I'll get to that cabbie looking for housing help, Jabrel in Manhattan.
Yeah.
On WNYC. Hi.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I love your show. Recently, I won the lottery for an affordable housing, and I went for an interview with this man. And a couple of 2 months later, I received a letter that my income is too low. And I disputed that fact, and I submitted some evidence. And a couple of days later, I received another letter that my income is too high. So as a cabbie, as a cab driver in New York City, I want to know how do I qualify for an affordable housing? Because let's say 60% of my total revenue almost go to the medallion company, you know, and gas.
Was there a certain window, if your income was first deemed too low and then deemed too high, was there a certain narrow window for that particular affordable housing project that you had to earn?
Yes, because after taking off the medallion payment and the gas, what I left over is like $20,000, and my wife makes like $15,000. So in that combination, I was assuming that we would qualify for right. for affordable housing.
So, Commissioner, how does that kind of thing work?
So it's actually a great question that your caller has brought. The way that folks qualify for our units, and it's an important distinction, frankly, between what we do and the general rent-stabilized stock out in the marketplace, the way we set rents and the way we qualify families for our units is based on them paying no more than 30% of their household income towards rent. That's a widely accepted across the country standard for what affordability means. And so we run a lottery process and a rigorous income qualification process to ensure that families are paying no more than 30% of their income in rent.
And does that count before or after his medallion payments?
It's based on the gross income coming into the family. So it's exactly how that was calculated for and how his medallion payments were taken into account. I can't say right
so,
now.
So what can Jabril do? It sounds like maybe Jabril applied for the lottery for the wrong kind of affordable housing for his income, or he thought it was the right kind. What can he do?
Well, the key thing to do is to continue to work with both the owner of that development to understand the income qualification process. But the second thing to do is to reach out to my agency HPD and talk to our staff about how this process works and ensure that you know the income was calculated in the right way.
Hey, Jabril, call their office and tell them you talk to the commissioner on the Brian Lehrer Show. Okay.
Can I get that number, maybe?
The easiest way to do it, Jabril, is to call 311, and they'll route you directly to HPD.
All right, Jabril, you call 311 and get there. And remember to use that clout that you now have. Tell them you talked to the commissioner on the Brian Lehrer Show, and he said you should follow up. Okay, you do that. Let's take another call. Here's Jeffrey in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jeffrey.
Yes, good morning. I would like to know, how does the housing, the preferential housing affordability that you can really impact on the total really need of housing in Antigua? What percentage do they really provide? Because recently, I mean, over the years in Bloomberg's time, rents have gone up, so that increases the number of people who really need affordable houses. Property tax have gone up, which increases the need for rent increase. So all around, you have people paying 60, 65%, 70%. And it appears that this affordable housing is not even, is like a storm in a teapot, a tea bag in a storm. Because how can you really solve the problem? You're not dealing. On the other hand, you're applying for building a few units for affordable housing. But on the aspect of the thing, you have the increases in the number of people who really need affordable mm-hmm. housing. And
right.
how can you really deal with how are you tackling the situation?
Jeffrey, thank you. It's the enormity of it, Commissioner. It's, you know, it's the tempest in the teapot. It's the pebble in the ocean of all these tides of declining incomes and rising property taxes, which puts pressure on the landlords, and you know, and the influx of population.
You know, clearly, Brian, this is affordable housing is one of the most important issues that face New Yorkers on a day in and day out basis. You know, we are very aware of the enormity of the challenge that New York's families and households face. I think that's exactly why we have stepped up to do more than any other city in this country, more than any other mayor of the city to do, and we're trying to do our part to ensure that there's more affordable housing and that overall the market in New York City is more affordable and there's more opportunities. And just one fact on this, Brian, that I think is an important fact. The Housing Vacancy Survey, which is something that HPD does every 3 years to survey the rental housing market in the city, some 2.5 million units of rental housing around this city. It's the most comprehensive survey of its kind in the country. HPD has been doing it for decades. Between 2005 and 2008, for the first time in two decades, contract rents, the rent that a person pays for a unit, rose at the exact same percentage as incomes. On a citywide basis, those are the kinds of statistics that we see that tell us that the new housing marketplace plan, the enormity and the scale of our effort is starting to have an impact in the marketplace.
Do you think also then that the recession, ironically, has been good for affordable housing?
You know, affordable housing, I've been doing affordable housing my entire career, has always been somewhat of a counter-cyclical business because there are opportunities to keep units affordable in a recession that don't exist in a boom time. And what we want to do is take advantage of that opportunity so that we can have the kind of impact that your caller and most New Yorkers want us to have. I use those statistics in not any way to dispel the enormity of the challenge. I think Mayor Bloomberg has said on many occasions what we're doing is enormous and it's important and it is having market effects. But at the end of the day, it's 2.5 million rental units. It's an enormous challenge, and we need all of our partners at the federal level, the state level, to work together to make New York City more affordable.
Let me touch a few news items with you before you go.
Sure.
There's all this halted development in New York, as you know, and we've had Hakeem Jeffries, the assemblyman from Brooklyn, on a couple of times talking about his quest to get all those vacant luxury apartments that have been built but can't be sold or rented into the hands of people who need affordable housing. Are you trying to do that, or do you think that's pie in the sky and those rightful owners have the right to wait for the tenants who can afford those units?
Brian, this is one of the great questions of this recession. We've been working very closely with Assemblyman Jeffries, but also with Speaker Quinn. We actually put a pilot program together over the summer, $20 million, called the Housing Asset Renewal Program, which is a program where we're hoping that we can work with owners of buildings, whether that's the bank owns it because they foreclosed on the developer, or whether the developer is looking for a way to work out their challenge. We literally have talked to dozens of owners around the city and are working right now to try to see if we can use that pilot program as a way to make those units affordable.
Have you actually placed anybody in any such units? You have a number of people?
We have not yet, Brian, and I think this speaks to the challenge of the problem. So while I do not at all say that it's pie in the sky, I think this is an enormously complex issue, and the banks and the owners of those buildings have to be ready to make a deal with us in order for us to be successful.
And what do you think about the Stuyvesant Town ruling? If that stands, it'll force the owners to return deregulated units to rent stabilization because they get the J51 so-called tax break. Good ruling?
Real quickly, Brian, I think it's important to just understand the facts of the ruling. What the ruling that came down from the Court of Appeals did was say that any unit going forward, from the day of the ruling going forward, that has J51 cannot deregulate through vacancy or high rent decontrol.
It's not going to be retroactive?
The issue of retroactivity is still before the courts and will be decided as part of an ongoing litigation.
Does the Bloomberg administration have a position on that question?
We don't. We don't. We really believe that the courts will hear that case and will make the decision based on the facts in front of them, and are, like everybody else, waiting for the courts to make that final decision.
And the Atlantic Yards court ruling today, they can go forward with eminent domain. It is sufficiently in the public interest, according to the New York State Court of Appeals. Your reaction?
I think that hopefully this is a moment in time when we can move forward with the Atlantic Yards development project. Not only is the project going to create an arena, an enormous economic development engine for downtown Brooklyn, but it's also going to create thousands of units of affordable housing. So we're eager to get moving on it. We hope that this ruling will clear the way so that we can move forward.
The opponents and the skeptics say it's exactly that affordable housing that's going to be the first thing to fall by the wayside if the developer has to scale it down for the economy. How do you make sure that that stuff gets built and not just the parts that are going to be the most profitable?
You know, again, Brian, I think our track record of creating and preserving affordable housing around the city speaks for itself. 94,000 units we've done already. We believe we can make affordable housing work at Atlantic Yards.
But how do you push the Radnor folks particularly?
I think just like we work with any developer around the city, we work with them, we put a set of programs and financing tools in place that work and allow them to move development projects forward, and that's how we get it done. They want to move forward with this just like we do.
Is it about enforcement at this point, making sure they stick to what's in the community benefits agreement?
I think it's about having the right financing tools available for developers to be able to create affordable housing, and I think we have those. I think our track record shows that we have those, and I think in the case of Atlantic Yards, over time people will see that those tools will allow us to move forward with the affordable housing program that's been laid out.
Rafael Sestero, the not brand new but recent Housing Preservation and Development Commissioner under Mayor Bloomberg, now that his predecessor, Sean Donovan, has been tapped by President Obama to be the Secretary of HUD at the federal level. Commissioner, thank you so much. We look forward to talking to you more.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. We will get a glimpse at the building I know you've all been waiting for, the newly designed Bush Presidential Library. Stay with us.